If you've been listening to me for a while, two things. One, I'm very sorry. But two, you get a medal for it soon. But two is, you know that I'm that worst sort of person who's an armchair historian. And I like to talk about history, and I like the length and breadth and the characters that we cover in history. Now, the subject of my next book, William Shaw Lindsay, Victorian Entrepreneur, is like a who's who. He met a who's who of an astonishing array of Victorian luminaries. Buchanan, Garibaldi, Gladstone, Disraeli, Brunel, Nightingale, Dickens, Paxton, Emperor Napoleon III, and Queen Victoria herself. Delighted to be to say, joining me live on the line to tell me more about William Shaw Lindsay, Victorian Entrepreneur, is Bill Lindsay. Bill, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, it's bright and sunny here in the UK.
Well, that's always good to hear. That's a who's who, isn't it? That's a Debrett's, if you like, of the Victorian age. It's a fascinating and inclusive range of characters.
Yeah, I was absolutely amazed. I mean, I knew nothing about my great-great-grandfather. And then I found out that his diaries were held in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich and had been unpublished. So I took it on myself to transcribe all that he had written. And he had written a heck of a lot, over a million words I actually transcribed.
Wow.
And that took me 6 years. And the book is the result. But yeah, absolutely amazing stuff that came out of his diaries.
So tell me a little bit about then who he was. Because, you know, Victorian entrepreneur, I'm buckling in my swash. What are we doing here? Because it's originally, he doesn't come from a name. He comes from a very, very poor background indeed.
Yeah, yep, he did. I mean, he was orphaned by the time he was 10. His father died when he was 4, and then his mother died when he was 10. His uncle, who was a reverend in Ayrshire, brought him up, but he ran away to sea. He actually had given £5 by his, which is quite a lot of money, I suppose, by his reverend uncle. But that was stolen on the way to the Clyde. And so he had about two shillings and sixpence. And he worked his passage. He had to go down to the coal. This was early days of steamers to work the coal and to work his passage. And then he got to Liverpool, and he was six or seven weeks on the docks living rough until he finally found a place on a ship as an apprentice. But I mean, the amazing thing was that he'd worked his way up, and by the 1850s, he'd owned one of the largest shipping companies in the UK. But by the mid-50s, he had 22 ships under his name, and he was chartering 700. So he was about like, it was a bit like Branson of his day.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely amazing stuff from nothing.
From being destitute on the docks at the age of 15 to what, 45, 30 years later, he's got a fleet of ships, and like as you said, you know, not only that, but he's got an in-depth knowledge of the industry itself, because he's worked his way through basically every role there is on a boat.
That's right. He was a captain after 9 years. And had many exploits on and close escapes, actually, with death. Yellow fever. I mean, out of something like 31 on the crew, 15 had died. And he'd find that people either side of him on hammocks had died, but it didn't touch him. So that was just one of many near escapes he had with death. But, yeah, he came through it, and he did very well. I mean, what actually made him was... he started the company that he was working for had a coal mine in the north of England.
Yeah.
And they said, right, come and work for us and ship coal down to the southern ports, which he did. And he made a success of that. But after a while, he thought, right, I'm going to do it myself. He went down to London and he set up his own ship brokerage build business. And this was the advent of shipping lines really making an impression. So what he did was to speak with the owners of the shipping lines, like P&O and Cunard and others. And at that time, they were using Welsh coal, but he convinced them that north of England coal was just as good. And that really set him off on his way. And that's where he started making his money. But it was the Crimean War that really made his money, because his ships were used by the government there.
I mean, just going back, because we tend to forget, because, you know, here we are in the 21st century and we're talking solar energy and whatever else. But even up until into the Second World War, the amount of coal that was being shipped around the UK was a huge amount. It was an absolutely phenomenal amount of coal. You know, on Churchill's War Room, there's maps of the shipping, you know, every day. And it's just the UK is just covered in sort of little black dots, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was heavy competition. I mean, it's hard to imagine these days, because what with cars and aeroplanes and everything else, I mean, in those days, there were really, trains hadn't come about. So shipping was the main mode of transport. And each harbour was just full of, like a forest, really, of sailing ships. But as you allude to, you know, steamships were beginning to come in a big way, and coal was being used all over the place, yeah.
So the Crimean War. Now, he makes his money from that, but he also makes his name from it as well, because unlike perhaps some of the, you know, the great archetypal rebel Victorian baron, etc., he's got a conscience about it, and he thinks about the welfare of the people and who are being, you know, the poor bloody infantry who are being shipped out there.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's again, the script actually that in the text in his diaries is amazing, because it's sort of easy English to follow. It's not written in a sort of early Victorian way. You can really follow it, and actually, it brings everything to life. And what he found was that he was really incensed by the mismanagement of the government and the Admiralty. I mean, by that time, he'd just become an MP, so he had a voice in Parliament. And so he was really challenging the government at that time about mismanagement. Tables were being sent out without legs. Regiments were in, for instance, one regiment was in South Africa, but the paperwork wasn't right. So when a ship went along to pick them up, they couldn't, because it wasn't sanctified. So you know, they had to be left behind, and there were numerous examples of that. And you're right. I mean, the classic example was they wanted more boots for the troops in the winter, and requisition boots from the UK, but there was a ship already out there with boots on it. And what it was that because he was in merchant shipping, the records there, they had inventories of what was going in, when it was going out, etc. But the Navy didn't have this. It was really haphazard. So he really laid into them.
And also, you mentioned that, here we go, because we're back to that other thing, that other great Victorian thing, the philanthropist, you know, the industrialist stroke philanthropist doing things for, you know, we think of like Bernardo's, something like that, or, you know, those great charitable, the Guinness buildings, for example, in London. And so, presumably, you know, he's getting involved in politics as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, it was third time lucky. The first time he sat for Monmouthshire, down in Wales, and there was a heck of a lot of corruption there. There was riots going on and all sorts of stuff to try and put him off. He went and sat as a sort of a radical liberal, an independent liberal, and he was against the Tories. And the guy there who won the seat, he was a big iron merchant down there, and he owned lots of people working for him, basically, and he just corrupted them. And so Lindsay had no chance of getting in. And then he sat the second time up against an admiral in Dartmouth. And of course, that was difficult as well. And they were up to all shenanigans.
Sure.
But again, finally, he won a seat in Tynemouth. He was having no truck with the idea of corruption. He wanted to win his seat fairly and represent the people. And as you allude to, you know, he was a people person. He was trying to assist the locals and the poor, really.
The other thing just struck me, you talk about the fact that his diaries, and of course, being in shipping where they keep ledgers of everything you said, like in the merchant navy. So he's having to write a lot. So doing a daily diary or a daily log isn't going to be a problem for him. But presumably, I mean, he kind of taught himself to write pretty much, because maybe that's the style that he's not so full of Victoriana and artifice when it comes to actually writing. You know, he writes like he speaks, because he's got an elementary, in the nicest possible way, he's got an elementary education, which he improves himself.
Yep. He had about, from what I can gather, about 3 years actually in Ayr Academy. And again, that was sort of helped by his reverend uncle. That was sort of basic stuff. And when he was on board ships, you're right, he educated himself. And one of the things that he did big time was to look at navigation law, interestingly enough. And I mean, that reaped rewards as well, because skipping forward to the Crimean War, he went over to France. He was shipping French troops out from France to the Crimean War because he was assisting chartering their ships for them. But he met the emperor out there and discussed about navigation law as well as assisting the troops getting out. And one of the incidentally on that front, he was suggesting that why don't they bring back the wounded troops from the Crimea to Marseille and hospitalize them there rather than out in the Crimean War, because out in the near the Crimea,
yeah,
because of disease, etc., out there, and they took that on board. He was a self-educated man by and large. He was a typical epitome of a Victorian man doing well for himself.
And not only that, so he's doing stuff for the Crimea, and then if that wasn't enough to keep you the reader's interest, he hops across the pond. He goes to the northern states just before the American Civil War.
Yep. And that was quite an adventure. Again, he went out there to discuss navigation law. I mean, what would happen? There was a disconnect between what the laws of the sea in the States and the laws of the sea over here and in Europe. So, for instance, you know, do you go port starboard or whatever? All these things were, you know, what happens if someone deserts? How they managed? All these types of things. There was a disconnect. So he's trying to get that going, and he toured the American states, and again it comes out in the diaries. I mean, I was amazed. He met the president elect, who happened to be a certain Abraham Lincoln,
okay,
and had dinner with him. And you just, I mean, as you allude to right at the start, you know, all these names spring forward. He met the president, who was Buchanan, who incidentally, I think Americans class as the second worst president of the United States.
Yeah, okay, let's not go even over the first one is. But anyway, let's move swiftly to the current affairs program. Was he aware of the Inklings that Civil War, because presumably he met them in the 50s, and of course American Civil War, like 1864 to 1860-something, 1868, I think.
It's 1861 it started.
Oh, 61, April. Thank you.
Yeah. He went out the end of 1860, so right, it's actually very close to it. And he picked up on what was happening. And actually, that comes down to it. You know, you would have think, because you've got to remember, his ships were taking railway track out to the States and then bringing back corn and cotton from the States. So he had a lot of business in the States. But then he had to decide, okay, when the war broke out, who was he going to back? And again, I found this quite amazing. He backed the Confederates, the Southerners. And the reason for that, he goes into it in quite some depth, was due to taxation and because of representation in the Senate. And what he found out was that the northern states were more heavily populated than the South. They were industrialized, whereas the South were farmers, basically, with cotton. And therefore, in a given acre, for instance, there may be only one person compared to 2.5 persons up north, because it was more populated. But you were taxed according to the land, not per person.
Right.
So the Southerners were being more taxed heavily. So he felt that that was not right. And he felt that because of that, there were less representatives of the Southerners in this in the Senate as well. So they were getting a poor deal compared to the North. He was, don't get me wrong, I mean, slavery came into it and he abhorred slavery. And there are, again, examples of him traveling in the States in the North where there was discrimination against the blacks in the North as well. So interestingly enough, I think one of the things that really came out of it was that he didn't want all the slaves to be released at once, because he didn't think that there were going to be shelter, accommodation, and money, food for them if they were all released at once. And the reason for that was, again, going back to Liverpool, when he didn't have any help, there was no social security or anything like that. For the 7 weeks that he was on the docks, he had to fend for himself. And he was thinking, how can that happen in the South when all the slaves were released at once? He wanted a more gradual emancipation of slaves.
Going back to Europe, again, two names, obviously, obviously recognizable. Nightingale, presumably that's a Crimean War thing then, I would imagine, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one of his ships, the Robert Lowe, took her out. And interestingly enough, again, in her diaries, she mentions not the Robert Lowe, but the Robert Slow, because she wanted to get out there quicker. But yeah, and again, in his diaries, he says she got out there and there wasn't an office or a place where she could set up and organize things. So he allowed the captain of his ship allowed her 2 weeks on board so she could get her house in order, if you like.
And of course, Queen Victoria. Because it's a Victorian, I mean, it wouldn't be a Victorian entrepreneur story without meeting, you know, the monarch herself.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. And that comes back to the 1851 Great Exhibition that was in Hyde Park. And he happened to be there when she did an informal visit. And he had a big ship model, a model of one of his ships in a big case. And Her Majesty came round and looked at it. And the two princes wanted to have a closer look. And so Lindsay asked the Queen if he could do that and lifted one of the princes up. And the prince whispered something in his ear. And basically it was, can I have that anchor, which is in gold, that's on the model? And Queen Victoria heard that and really laid into the prince. And actually that... He sort of was quite taken by the way that Her Majesty had sort of treated and scolded her own children in a nice way, but really laid, you know, you're a prince, but you can't have everything, sunshine.
I'm just thinking, he's 1877 he dies. So that's what, 62? Relatively early, even for, you know, even for those times.
Yeah. And part of the problem with that, Giles, is that he had a stroke a year before the American Civil War ended. The pressure, and part of that was that he'd gone over to France. He had four meetings with the emperor to try and convince the emperor to support the South and give them independence as a nation. There was a sort of disconnect between the French emperor and the government over here. The government really didn't trust him that much. And anyway, it obviously didn't work. But yes, he had so much strain put on him that he had the stroke. And for the last 12 years of his life, he wrote. So he wrote novels. And his sort of big claim to fame in those days was writing the History of Merchant Shipping in four volumes, which was like the Bible of merchant shipping.
It describes it as a magnum opus, and it really does seem to be this hefty tome.
Yes. And actually, I mean, I've done so much work with transcribing, and I thought, right, I've done it all. And I went back to the library, the Caird Library in the National Maritime Museum, And there was a little file, a notation, basically, background to the history of merchant shipping. So I thought, I better have a look at this. And, of course, all it is that all the shipping owners, right, writing to Lindsay, saying, giving them information for the book that came out. But, of course, the book it had to be curtailed. So there's all this information still to go through.
How aware were you of your great-great... Am I getting... How many greats? Three? Great-great-great-grandfather?
Two.
You're great. So is it obviously a family legend, or were you aware... Were you kind of aware what you're getting into, Bill, is what I mean about this one?
No. And in fact, I had to harangue my father and say, come on, what did your father do in the First World War? And finally, he sort of said, well, there, have a look at this. And that's a whole nother story, Giles. That's all about the pre-SAS out in the desert in Egypt. But I sort of then did the family tree because he didn't know anything about it. And then I found out that this guy owned Shepperton Manor. And so I contacted the owner or the distant cousin. And that's a whole nother story. But then I found all this information, and it was just amazing. The interesting thing is that no one in the family had been bothered to do anything with all this information. So I thought, right, well, I'll have to do it myself, you know.
Yeah. Here's the thing. When you walk into somewhere like the Greenwich, you know, the National Maritime Museum, with the columns, and, you know, we are a maritime nation. You know, we tend to forget that sometimes, but that was how, you know, we ruled the waves, etc. And you see, you know, the names that trip off the tongue, and then there's a relative of yours, your great-great-grandfather, in there. It must make you feel, it must be a hell of a connect, Bill.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the other things was that there was a book written at the time about famous men who'd sort of come from nothing, or it was famous men of our times. It was a book of that. Dickens was in there, Disraeli was in there, and Lindsay was in there. I'm thinking, who is this guy? You know, but actually in his day, he was quite famous. He's obviously forgotten now, and obviously one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try and make sure he gets some recognition for his accomplishments.
What was the moment then? Because I always call it a eureka moment, where you know, you're scribbling away or you're transcribing away, and suddenly, bam, there's a little spark, and you go, right, got it. I exactly know, or you make that connect with the book, the subject, and in your case, you know, your long lost relation.
Well, yeah, there was a guy down in Bristol who I worked with quite well. He got in touch with me and he said, look, I've just come across Lindsay. I want to write the book. Will you help me do that? And I said, yeah. So I sent him all the transcriptions I'd done. And he said, I'm going to write the life and times of Lindsay. Well, a heck of a lot happened between 1815 and 1877. And after a year, he'd written about three chapters. And he said he'd going to be writing about five books. And then that was the eureka moment. It was basically, he's not going to do it. I've got to do it myself. I think, you know, he's actually getting on a bit now and probably won't be able to do it. But he's still plowing through all the information. And he would write a more academic book. I mean, the book that I've written hopefully is something for, you know, the general reader, the public. If they want, the academics want more information, then they need to go back to the source data in the library, you know?
The book is called William Shaw Lindsay, Victorian Entrepreneur. It's by Bill Lindsay. Bill, if people want to find you online, where can they get hold of you in the nicest way?
Yeah, the best way is BillLindsayHistorian.com. So it's all one word, Bill Lindsay.
And that's with an A rather than with an E. So it's Lindsay. The book is called William Shaw Lindsay, Victorian Entrepreneur. It's by Bill Lindsay. It's going to be available as well as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. For an armchair historian like me, Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Dahl's final point, my father lived 25 years in near Mohaka in Bedar.
Yep.
And so I'm absolutely delighted to be able to speak to you and all your listeners.
And the good people of Mohaka are probably raising a large, it's almost 12 o'clock, a large Theveto or something even stronger today. The book is called William Shaw Lindsay, Victorian Entrepreneur. Bill Lindsay, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you, Giles.